Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 96-year-old Harold Radish of Queens, New York, Douglaston to be exact. He served with the 90th Infantry Division before, during, and after the infamous Battle of the Bulge.
My outfit came to Bastogne to the Bulge just about near the end, so it wasn't that bad. But it was cold, but not that cold. We ended up in a warehouse of some kind. In that warehouse, surprisingly, there was a concrete floor. And I remember foxholes that had been blown out somehow in that concrete floor. I do remember it being cold, but not that cold. I remember looking out and seeing Germans coming at us in their white uniforms and people firing at them. And them going back, you know. The coldest I was in the prison camp. That was rough. Outside the camp, as I said on that February, that night was terrible. Then we got inside and we were in bunk beds. The bunk beds had slats of wood. And there was a little belly stove in this barrack. And this buddy and I, luckily I teamed up with a guy that was a bright guy. He was a staff sergeant. And he was bright and honest. And we worked together. J.J. McEntee, I remember him like, you know, it was yesterday. But I slept on the top. He slept in the middle. As it got colder, we would take the slats and put it in the stove. By the end, before we had a move, we were both sleeping on the floor, on the bottom. That was cold.
And I want to hear more about the prison camp. I'm sure I'm not the only one who'd be interested in the circumstances of your capture as well, because I'm sure you never expected or planned on becoming a prisoner. What was that when you had that realization?
This was after the Bulge. We were going through Luxembourg, etc., and we went to the Siegfried Line. The Germans called it the Wall. This was the border between France and Germany. And I think we were a stab kind of thing. What we did was my company would work at night. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd go in and sneak around a pillbox. We'd get around the pillbox, get to the door, and put a C2 or a charge right on the door and blow it in, and then we go right in and take it over so that the next day we could fire. There was usually a gun on top of the pillbox so that we can cover as the outfit behind us came in and started taking other pillboxes and moving in. The night that we started, we went in, we set up machine guns outside this big box, and we fired away. Apparently the Germans weren't there. We got into this box, then they came, and they started firing at us, and there was a steel door, I remember, slamming that shut, and we ended up, we were in a big bedroom. This was a gigantic concrete bedroom. There was one, two, or three rooms. One room had 25 Germans in it. We had captured 25. They were in bed, and that was it. But we couldn't get out, and that was it. We were there, I guess 3 or 4 days, and we had run out of water, and there was no food. The K rations, whatever rations we had, were used up. There must have been about 15 of us and a first lieutenant. I can remember drinking some of the water that was, you know, on the ground, etc., and that was it. And then one morning we heard a voice say, "Do you have any prisoners there?" with a heavy German accent. "Do you have any wounded?" That's what it was. Somehow the lieutenant said yes. And they made some agreement that for about a half hour or so, they would let him out to take a look around, and they would send in somebody to pick up the wounded. We had some German wounded in there, too. When the lieutenant came back, he said, "Fellows, it's all over. There's none of our troops around. We are thoroughly surrounded." And that was it. At that point, I was frightened. I was so frightened, I got rid of my dog tags. because on the dog tags was stamped H. I wasn't a hero, but I was going to save my life. And other people threw their dog tags away, too. There were some of the Catholic kids that threw their dog tags away because they felt that their religion wasn't recognized by the Germans. When they took us down into a little town and there were the German soldiers, they were frontline guys, and we were talking. We started to barter again. I had a little pack of juice, powder. German says, how many cigarettes? Well, talk about cigarettes. You could board all of Europe with cigarettes. That was the money. That was it. And from then, I wasn't frightened at that point because there was a different attitude. The further back you got behind the German lines, the tougher they got. Those are the things that, you're beginning to bring up memories.
Well, and I think most people are following along, but when you say you took off your dog tags because they had an H stamped on them, the H is for Hebrew, it would reveal your Jewish faith and perhaps make you a bigger target for your captors?
Yes, that's the way I felt. I felt it was a little not heroic, but I said, look, I got to save my life. That's it. I remember being interrogated when we came in. There was a German officer, and I sat down. He says, what is your, and his English was perfect. Your name and, your rank and your number and what did you do? What was your service? Well, I said, look, I can't tell you what I did. The regulation is I should give you my name, rank, and service number. And he said, okay. And he turns around and pulls down a window shade behind him. And on that shade was a whole lineup of the division and my regiment down to the companies of the latest second lieutenant that got killed.
Wow.
It was amazing. The information that they had was amazing. Then, to top it off, he says to me, Radish, oh, and that's when my mind was going around. I thought at that point I was going to get it. He says, Radish, what kind of name is that? And all of a sudden I said to him, it's like British, like pepper. And he laughed. He said, okay. Then the son of a gun pulled a deal on me. He says, do you have cigarettes? I said, yes, I have a few. He says, if you give me one cigarette, I can give you two of mine. I want to taste American cigarettes. I said, all right. I gave him three of mine, and he gave me six or seven, and that was it. And then he gave me a loaf of bread, a loaf of white bread,
wow,
which was fantastic because most of the time they gave us black bread. And that was to show that when you went out and you went in with the guys that you said, you must have said something to get a white bread. But everybody that was interrogated got a white bread. Bread. We'd get bread every morning, a hunk, a large piece of black bread. It must have been, 8 inches long by about 3 inches wide. That was for 12 guys. And we used to have cards or whatever. And the guy with the high card would get the knife. Somehow we had a knife to slice it into 12 even slices. The reason he would do it, he would be able to take a slice and the crumbs. But as he sliced, we had our eyes on him. It had to be exact. Otherwise, we'd scream. And this happened every morning.
And I don't know if this would have been exactly the same bread, but I've had a few ex-POWs tell me that black bread was mostly sawdust and not very easy to cut.
You're right. It was mostly sawdust, and there was hay in there or whatever it was. And then we got they came by with a barrel of what they called soup, but I think it was just black water, whatever. And you always had a cup, and they gave you, somebody. And, our group was non-coms. And as non-coms, the Germans wouldn't let us go out to work, so that we had to hang around in their barracks. And at the end of the day, at about 5 o'clock, we had what you called a Wall Street. You had guys that went out to work. And when they came back, they had to go through a little alley near a fence. And we would stand, about 5 or 6 feet away, and they would walk by. And while they were working on the farms or wherever it was, they would steal a fruit. They would bring a, either find an apple or a potato or something, and they'd hold it up. And you held up one finger, meaning a cigarette. And if the guy okayed, you threw the cigarette to him and he threw the apple to you. And somehow, these were not American soldiers that were coming by that had been working. I don't know where the other guys, you know, those that weren't non-coms, where they had sent them. It must have been to another area in that camp. But when they came by, if we had gotten a Red Cross package that had cigarettes in it, the price of the apple or the potato went up. It wasn't one, it was two. Somehow they knew. It was amazing. You know, the things that went on in the camp, we sort of regulated ourselves. Every morning there was a PEL. We would line up, and we had a master sergeant who was in charge, would line us up. We'd have a ceremony. We'd mention the names of those that had passed away. We had mentioned the names of those that had gotten sick and any news that there was. Somebody had a radio somewhere because we used to get news every so often on what was going on. Luckily, I wasn't a prisoner for too long. It's a couple of months, just enough to wet my feet, so to speak.
Which camps were you in?
12A, and then just before the end, when the British, we were up in a sector where the British were, when they got close, they moved us to another camp. Luckily, we were able to get into a truck or something. We didn't have to walk that far. When we got into the other camp, we were there maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, whatever it was. And one night, the camp had sort of emptied out of the German guards. Came in Americans with MP. I don't know where they got them, but these were guys with MPs and clubs. And they said, nobody leaves here because if you guys get out, you're going to get in the way. And you're going to get killed. And the next morning, the British had come in. So we were kind of happy because outside there was one of the British, like the Red Cross. They had a big truck there that was full of hot noodles. And they would give out the noodles and they made sure that we didn't eat too much because our stomachs weren't that good. They shaved us. They cleaned us. Oh, but that, you know, I didn't tell you. The worst part of the prison camp was the lice. Oh, God, that was all over you constantly. Every morning when you got up, if you slept, you'd pick the lice and snap them and crap them and whatever it was, and they never left you, never left you. That was the really hard part. The Germans knew that it was going to be ending soon. They didn't bother us too much. It was just no food, but the lice, that I remember. That comes up, and that's rough.
Did you end up losing some weight in captivity?
Oh, definitely. I must have lost about 15 pounds. In the prison camp, I remember going into a latrine and sitting there and watching, and all of a sudden, there's a guy there talking to the wall. So I looked up, and all of a sudden, he raises his arms up and pulls a block out of the wall, one of the cement blocks. And he pulls something out, a bread, and he puts the block back. I said to him, what are you doing? He says, you got anything? You want something? I said, all right, what can you do for me? He said, what do you got? Well, at that point, I had 2 pair of pants on, you know, to stay warm, not, of course, at a prison camp, but before I got captured. I said, I got a pair of pants. He said, okay, give it to me, and you get out of here. I said, why? He says, I don't want you to watch. Okay. I knew what happened. Apparently, he had somebody on the other side of the wall, made a deal, and he gave me a loaf of bread, and I don't know what he got. And I took the loaf of bread, and I went to McEntee, and I said, look what we got. He says, how'd you do that? And I explained it to him. There was another deal that we had. The night before we left 12A, some guy had snuck into the group and got a hold of McEntee and myself. He said, do you have food? And we had saved some extra cans because we had gotten a Red Cross package and we couldn't take it with us. So we had saved some stuff, you know, like the powdered milk and things like that. He said, I have a camera. And I said, well, what do you want? He says, How much? You know, we went back and forth dealing in the different stuff that we had from, I think, 9 o'clock at night till about 2 o'clock in the morning. And we ended up with the camera, and McEntee, he got the camera. So eventually, you know, I did meet him in the States, and he gave me some pictures, but I have no idea what the heck ever happened to the pictures. You know, we were sort of taking care of ourselves in the prison camp. The hard part was the food, with very little food, until you got a Red Cross package, so you had to be careful and make it last. And the pestilence, the lice and stuff, that was it. Luckily, there was a little spigot, there was water, so that, you know, at least you had water, so, you know, it wasn't that bad.
When you're a prisoner and you're not allowed to go out and work and you have all that time alone with your thoughts, did you ever think, I may not make it out of this? I may not make it back to the States again?
No. No. Nobody at 18 and a half or 19 feels that way. It's not going to happen. You're too busy thinking of what you were going to do that day. You know, how you're going to get by the day. And that was it. I never worried about being killed or anything like that. I was one of the lucky guys. I didn't have a wound on me.
Did you experience either witnessing or finding out that guys that you knew, guys that you served with, were not going to be able to come home?
Yes, there were a few guys. And I remember, well, one of the instances I remember, not in the camp, but on one of those freight cars where a guy just started screaming and yelling. He just lost it. And when we got out of the freight cars, they started taking bodies out, never realizing that guys had died in the cars.
So when you finally get liberated, and you said, you know, you were careful not to eat too much, how good did it feel to be a free man again after you had had to live in the absence of freedom?
It felt very, very good. The fact that I got cleaned, you know, they lined us up. They had these shears, you know, that you shear sheep. We, you know, we're all hairy guys. We got sheared and we got DDT was spread all over us. Now you can't use it, but they spread it all over us. We went into showers. We got clean. I felt good. I knew things that were going to be good.
What he didn't know was that his family still wasn't sure whether Harold was dead or alive. We'll hear about their reunion and how Harold was recently reunited with something he didn't even know was missing. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.